Welcome to a new episode of the Unicorn Bakery. My name is Fabian Tausch, and today we're looking at the recipe for success of Founder Collective. The Founder Collective invested in companies like Uber, BuzzFeed, Venmo, TradeTask, Periscope, and many, many more. Therefore, today's guest is Micah Rosenblum, managing partner of the Founder Collective. Micah built and sold several companies before he became a venture capitalist, and we will talk about picking startups a bit, in the super early stage, why you shouldn't celebrate valuations too much as a founder, and I think most importantly, a topic that nobody really talks about, what happens when you're not the perfect VC case, but you took on money from investors. So what happens if you have millions in the bank from investors, but you're not the perfect unicorn story and you're, for a VC fund, maybe the mediocre outcome, but you're still a great company? I would love to pick that topic in a few seconds. So as I'm very sure that it's interesting for lots of founders out there, let's dive right into it. Micah, welcome to the Unicorn Bakery.
Thank you, Fabian. It's a pleasure to be here. And these are topics I love to talk about. And if I can pay it forward as much as possible, I was an entrepreneur virtually right out of college before the blogosphere and before a lot of content existed. And so we had to figure it out on our own. And I think there's just so much opportunity now to get up the learning curve so much quicker. So if I can be a part of that, it's my privilege and honor to do that.
Thanks for being here. I would start with a question that I always like to ask VCs because it's very helpful for founders. How do you think about picking founders and startups in the early stage? What is important to you?
Yeah. And even I just want to back up for a second and say we think a lot about language. And so because we think language dictates behavior. And so we actually don't use the word picking very much. And we actually don't love the word unicorn. No disrespect. I love the name Unicorn Bakery, by the way, as a show name. It's great. The reason we don't use the word picking is we really feel like we're partnering with our founders. It's not merely a transaction like buying a share of Tesla, but literally could be a decade or more of a relationship. So the picking, yes, that's part of the process, but it's a very small part of an overall, multi-variable equation over a long period of time that involves a lot of people. So, to the question of how we think about it, we are in some ways like glorified sales reps. Our business has a sales kind of front end to it, which means we see thousands and thousands of opportunities every year. We actually put anything we get inbound goes into a CRM, which we've created in Airtable. We've got a team of about 7 people, including myself, that winnow that down, but we look at everything. And then now that some of that stuff comes, about a third comes from other investors, about 25% comes from other entrepreneurs in the portfolio. Some of them come from accelerators. Some of them come in cold. Some of them come in, discussions with university students who are, in fact, Whoop, which my partner Eric led, came from a university accelerator at Harvard. Will was an undergrad student there. So they come from all different places, and then we winnow it down and usually make roughly 15 investments per year. So just to give you a sense, and so a lot of what we're doing day to day is, marketing, doing things like this, talking to whether it's students or other entrepreneurs or organizations, tweeting, blogging, talking to our portfolio and reminding them that, we are always looking for the next great entrepreneur. The process for winnowing it down, so we, we'll take about a couple hundred meetings every year. So we'll end up investing in just shy of 1% of the things we meet on. So just to give you a sense, it is quite a lean funnel as you get down the process. I do think a lot of the way we think about it is less about what is the business content. Everybody gets so, especially we're all ex-founders. One of the unique things about Founder Collective is we've all built companies. But funny enough, we care less about what company you're building and much more about who it is, why they're building it, why they're uniquely suited to build that company. What was the inspiration to do it? Much like what was the inspiration for you to build this podcast? Why is there such great founder business fit? And we really zero in on that. And over the course of several meetings, do some diligence, I like to meet people face to face. I like to also go have a coffee or a drink to get to know what is motivating these founders. And that's really the process. And some go very quickly, some go more slowly. I would say in the last couple of years, those processes went too quickly. Now they're back to somewhat more of a normal pace, maybe still a little too quickly. But that's the gist of it. And I'll let you kind of direct me from there, but hopefully that's helpful.
You said now we're a bit more back to normal. I also talked to founders and they were like, yeah, I'm not sure if I should raise right now, for example, when they're bootstrapping or anything. They're like, yeah, but because multiples are not back in like 2020, 2021 manner, so why should I raise right now? It doesn't really make sense. And then my valuation isn't that high. And then not sure if that makes sense. And when we met in New York, you were like, yeah, founders are celebrating valuations too much. And I would love to hear what your thoughts are on this.
Yeah, the cult of the valuation and the cult of how much you raised and marketing that, I think was a real negative in the industry over the last couple of years. I think this almost like, you know, I raised this much, you raised this much, and it sort of became this war of fundraising. And fundraising, is really gas in the tank. It's not, I don't believe it's something that necessarily should be celebrated. Revenue, people were talking more about how much fundraising they did and at what valuation versus how fast they were growing or what their revenue was. And I think it created a whole bunch of misaligned incentives. I think a lot of founders attracted other employees because of the valuations. The employees weren't asking the right questions. They weren't asking about the fundamentals. They were like, that company just raised $50 million from Andreessen. And it was like, well, okay, but let's unpack whether we think this is a good place to to start a career or to build a career. So I think it created this spiral of fundraising that focused on the wrong things for both founders and employees. I at the risk of sounding like the old man back in my day, but it was kind of like salaries. Nobody talked about it. You didn't talk about how much you raised. That was kind of your private, those were internal things that the senior folks in the team would worry about. And I think that was healthier. I think we stayed a lot less focused on our competitors and how much they raised. And I think stayed out of the war of fundraising because, I look back at some of our best companies and they were not the most funded company in the category. They were not the ones that trumpeted the highest valuations. We really focus on multiples and we really focus on founder outcomes. And frankly, high valuations don't always correlate to great founder outcomes. And I think people forgot that a little bit, or were almost jaded by the PR and by the blogosphere that and I think the term unicorn, and I hate to pick on it given the name of the podcast, but I think the name unicorn sort of corrupted a little bit of the point of building a venture-backed startup. Venture-backed startups are, uniquely fast accelerating companies. The outcomes can vary from, $50 million to billions of dollars. But it's all a function of how much money went in, how many founders, how dilutive, how many investors. We were fortunate. You and I have talked about the company I started. We raised probably sub $10 million. We sold our company for $95 million. And, by today's standards, that may not seem like a big exit number, but by a multiples basis in terms of the dollars in, was quite good. So some of it is sort of relearning or reestablishing what the goal is and remembering, and then I'll let you jump in with the question, but remembering the VC's incentive varies quite a bit and is often different than the entrepreneur's incentive. They're not completely aligned. It is not necessarily true that the VC may be playing the billion or bust game. They really want you to be 5 billion to greater to move the needle on their fund. That may not be the best outcome for you as a founder. And so I think entrepreneurs have to kind of think through that alignment, and not all investors have the same risk profile. So I think we should go back to the basics and understand, does it make sense to raise venture money? Who should we raise venture money from? How much should we raise? And not just the bigger the number, the better. I think that was a big mistake over the last 5 to 10 years.
I would love to say that I totally understand what you're saying with the older days. Like the honest truth is that I'm like just experienced with the hype cycle from 2016-17 onwards. Yeah. So therefore, but about picking the name Unicorn Bakery, for example, I picked it because a lot of founders aspire to build a unicorn, and I would love to get the attention and then also help building solid companies. And it doesn't always have to be a unicorn, because maybe not every, like at first, not every company can become a unicorn. Not every founder should try to build a unicorn. Some should also just bootstrap or build smaller businesses and healthy businesses. And not that unicorns are not healthy, but you know what I mean. And yeah, it's playing the attention game a bit. So therefore, I'm totally with you that I think it's hard that everybody is only talking about valuations, and then multiples, like, yeah, we have like a 30 to a 60 x on our revenues as our valuation. You're like, okay, that's cool, but how long do you have a runway? Oh, you don't even have the chance to grow into that until the next round. How do you want to play that game? So there's so many things that are issues, especially for the founders who started in the last, let's say, 2, 3, maybe 4 years, because they automatically, when you got the seed, you got the Series A pretty much, with a preempted round here, and not because of the numbers, but just because of, oh, you got an investment from X or Y, and that's why everything is now laid out. And here's, for example, Tiger coming and saying, hey, take our money. So yeah, I really like the discussion here, and therefore,
yeah, if I think I could, sorry.
Sure. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to propose a new, we could create it here, a new definition for unicorn. I don't think valuation should be the criteria. I think, remember, $1 billion it's a round number, but it's a very arbitrary number. It could have been 750, it could have been $1.5 billion, it could have been 3, but it's an arbitrary number. It's just a round number. I think a unicorn is any company that grows, let's say 3x 3 years or more, 3x year on year for 3 years. To me, that's a unicorn. Any company that can grow quickly at any stage, consistently for some period of time, that's a unicorn. Most companies can't do that. The plumbing company can't do that. Well, maybe some can. The restaurant, very few can. But if you can, in any context, you're a unicorn. You don't have to be worth $1 billion. I think if you can grow unusually quickly, and that's what venture capital is about, those very few unicorns, doesn't mean it matter valuation, that grow unusually fast and warrant extra capital to invest way ahead of their fundamentals. And so I think unicorn is actually a great word. I just think it's been bastardized a bit.
Yeah, everybody's just trying to get the status of, yeah, we now have this and that valuation. So I think the question that I need to ask from a founder's perspective is, what happens if I weigh my valuation too much? What happens if I overshoot my valuation? And therefore, how should I think about valuation instead?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of, I mean, I don't know how long you have. I could probably go on all day about the dangers of high valuations. I'll give you like very quick anecdotes. I've been in calls with founders when valuation went way up, and founders said to me, I hear my employees talking about what kind of car they're going to buy, the houses they're going to buy, and I'm really worried. And I said, you should be, because they're cashing a check they don't yet have. You've intellectually or psychologically convinced your company they're all holders of shares in a $1 billion company. But the truth is they're not. Nobody would buy those shares at the moment. Yes, one investor came in and bought preferred shares at that price. But they can't go buy a house, they can't go buy a car with those shares. So you've got to communicate that to them, or you're going to have very disappointed employees if you don't live up to the valuation. You can imagine the pressure that puts on the founder to live up to that, and to the employees, and the disappointment if it doesn't happen. People will leave very quickly, and a lot of that happened. I also recall an experience. One of my partners was saying, we had a company whose valuation, very successful company, very exciting, and a great founder, who was disappointed that the valuation was between $900 million and $1 billion and not at $1 billion. And, you know, I remember our discussion saying, what's the difference? You created something from zero to 950 million. Who cares if it's not a billion? Like, it's sort of the wrong discussion. And so I think it just leads to a lot of bad behavior. And it's, you know, I think this is where, you know, sorry, as a sidebar, I always think about Warren Buffett, you know, outside of in Omaha, Nebraska, you know, in the middle of the United States, outside of the echo chamber of the Bay Area. I imagine Berlin has some of this echo chamber now as well. Certainly New York, Boston, LA, San Francisco, where everybody's talking about it. So you get caught up in it. And there's actually value to getting the heck away from that and saying, you know what, I'm just going to put my head down and I'm going to go in the bunker. And I do think that's why people like Warren Buffett, as crazy as it seems, not being in New York City as a investor was probably the best thing that ever happened to him, because he could think objectively. And when something looked crazy, and even though, you know, we're humans, we're very easily, we can be very convinced and manipulated to believe something very easily. But when you're not in that echo chamber, it's just a little easier to kind of say, boy, those guys are smoking some crazy stuff over there, paying $1 billion for the company that's doing $1 million in revenue or $5 million in revenue or zero in revenue. And so, I think objectivity, I'm not sure if I'm answering your question well, but I think, can you maintain objectivity, intellectual objectivity, intellectual honesty as a founder, as an investor? I think that's really hard, but I do think that's really important.
Yeah, I'm totally with you. I don't like the term realistic because it's like also overused for things where people are not realistic. But try to be like a bit more radical on like, okay, what would I, if I would be on the other side, what would be a bit more, fair is also the wrong word, but what would be appropriate to pay as a price for the valuation? Because of course, you're not diluting as much if you're in a later stage and the valuation is higher, but there are so many risks that are coming with too high of a valuation. The one is you will have a lot of issues raising a next round if you're not growing fast enough, if you're not efficient enough, if your numbers are not perfect. The later you are, the more perfect your numbers have to be. And if you cannot grow into that, then there might not be a tomorrow. Or with such bad conditions and hard terms that will dilute you that much afterwards that the average out of the two rounds is way worse than if you took a lower valuation. So there's so many reasons that you also can talk to other founders about and figure out quite quickly why it makes sense to at least approach it with an open mindset and not like very forced on like, yeah, I have to have this valuation. Just stressing it because I still meet a lot of founders who are a bit too much into, oh, I want to have X valuation, otherwise I don't raise or don't want to raise, or it doesn't feel right, or I'm worth more. Probably you're not, but just a small rant and a small monologue on my perspective on valuations.
It's very true. And, it's the valuation correlates to how much capital is being raised. Those things usually go hand in hand. And as the funds got bigger, the valuations got higher and the dollars in got more. And the real problem actually is less of the valuation. That's part of the problem, as we've been talking about. But the real problem is too much capital. You know, it's a funny thing. You know, you would think that more money is better, that you can grow faster, you can do more, you can hire more people. But the opposite is really true, because think about the big companies. You know, we were talking about the time I spent in Germany, and I sold the company to 3M. 3M had a big facility there and all over the globe. It's, you know, I forget, 60,000 people. Fortune 100 company. By definition, the scale of companies like that, the government is the biggest example, you just get less efficient on a per person basis, on a per employee basis. Like the bigger the organization, the less efficient it is, just by definition. And so why would you as a startup, what a startup has, the special thing a startup has is it moves really quickly, it's highly efficient, it's small and nimble, you know, it's like that little crack army that can get a lot done with limited resources. The minute you start stuffing it with resources, it actually becomes much more like the big companies you're trying to disrupt. So it's actually, it may seem counterintuitive. It's actually better to have less capital. I'm not saying no capital, but it is better to have one marketer instead of 10 marketers in many cases until you reach a certain scale where you need 10 marketers. But what happens is these companies raise a lot of money early, and it's a slippery slope. You know, the one marketer needs a second marketer. The second marketer needs a, you know, the sales rep needs a BDR. The BDR needs an AE. The AE needs a sales ops person. The sales ops person needs an analyst. And all of a sudden, you have this army, this massive group of people. And that's why you see a lot of layoffs now, because these organizations just got spent too much money on staff. And so it creates all these bad habits that you would think founders would try to avoid in the early days. What's special about a startup is quick communication, you know, people who are really inspired to build a great company, not in it for money necessarily, but really in it for the mission, obviously for the money long term, but like to create a company. And so I think the core problem is raising too much too early, spending too much, and thinking money will solve your problems. I've just never seen that to be the case. I've seen the companies with $1 million or $2 million out of the gate actually have an easier time than companies that raise five. Seems counterintuitive, but the companies that have $1 million or $2 million, they got to figure it out. They got to get to product market fit on $1 million or $2 million. The companies with five, in some ways, feel a little bit less pressure. They may start to scale only to later figure out they didn't have product market fit because they had so much resource. They sort of lulled themselves into believing that they could, grow their way into product market fit or spend their way into product market fit. It just doesn't work that way. And so, and if you look at any great organization, you don't need to starve the organization, but, you know, there was an old saying in venture, more companies die of, overfeeding than starvation. And I think it's really true. And I think it's true of, you know, the last few years of companies, and hopefully many of them figured that out quickly enough to correct it. But we'll certainly see over the next year or two.
I'm totally with you. I think one of the questions that arises is, on the one hand, what if I raised too much money already and have a too high of a valuation? I think that's one part of it. But at the same part, what if I'm not growing as fast as I wanted to after my last round, and I might become a solid company but not the perfect venture case? How do I behave? Because my VCs and investors might be like, yeah, that's nice, but sorry, we're looking for something else, like a bit more like dropping the potato, even if you hope that the VCs don't do it, but you know what I mean, that they also love to focus on the best performing ventures. So how should founders, like, what is the honest conversation that founders have to have with themselves or their co-founders and their investors when they realize that it won't be the billion-dollar company that they're building, and not from the unicorn state, but also maybe $1 billion in revenues, which would be amazing. But therefore, I think the question of what happens if all the dream that I sold myself and sold to investors and sold to employees of I want to build this huge and perfect company that I, or not perfect, but the huge company that I can IPO at NASDAQ at one point, doesn't come true.
Yeah. And by the way, I think investors who have done this, we're coming into our, for me, it's about my 11th year as an investor, and I spent about equal amount of time as a founder. We've seen a lot of different permutations of this. For example, there are a number of companies that, let's say over a 10-year period, bumped along, grew, maybe had some really tough years, and became $20 million revenue businesses over 10 years, $40 million businesses, $10 million businesses. And a lot of the VCs along the way gave up. And, you know, in some cases, we have seen founders say, I want to buy out my investors. I'm going to create a deal structure where they get 2x, 3x their money back, paid out over some period of time, or some portion of EBITDA. You don't see that a lot. And a lot of investors, the big investors, kind of walk away and don't care. I think the more aligned investors say, let's create a structure so you know, if this isn't going to be the 10x return that we had all hoped, but it's a great business for you, you're the founder, let's figure out a way to make that happen. And by the way, I can think of companies off the top where, you know, lo and behold, these are really going to be valuable. These founders are going to have life-changing outcomes, but it took longer. It's not going to be the massive outcome for some of the funds that got involved. So we have seen founders buy out their investors and go on to what some people call lifestyle companies. I think they're much better than that, but let's call them non-unicorn exciting companies. And I think, so that's one thing. I think another, I think there are, and there will be on the other extreme of this, a number of companies that just need to shut down, and that the venture math and the product market fit just isn't there. The, you know, perhaps 10 million was burned. There's still a few million in the bank, but it's not a good use of time for the founders any longer. And if they don't have the spark, rather than try to burn the last three to figure it out, just give the money back. And we're seeing that too. We've seen some founders, in fact, the founder that I'm close to in Berlin said to me, you know, we're gonna give the money back. So, I by the way, I don't, you know, some investors will say, yeah, just figure, you know, I don't care. It's less about the actual amount of money, and it's about when the founders know they're spending good time after bad. It's good for everybody to just move on, and whether it's 20% of the capital left or 80 or 10. Let's move on and let's work on the next thing. And that's generally my attitude. You know, we're seeing other permutations as well, like recapitalizations, recaps. So what happens there? Well, maybe there is actually intrinsic value. I've seen this with a lot of categories, like e-commerce, where the market has really turned against these types of companies, but they have real revenue. They just were priced at software multiples or multiples of 5 years ago. And now you can't get out from under that. And if the founders are still motivated and there's real revenue in the business and real progress, sometimes the thing to do, and usually it's against our interest as investors, because if there's a recap, and we don't encourage this, but sometimes it is the only outcome to keep the company going, you reprice, and the early investors like us, mostly people like us, you know, have to either come back in or we're heavily diluted. But it gives the founders an opportunity to kind of start over from a baseline that makes more sense and has more upside for them and everybody else. So, look, all these things are hard. Everybody wants to just go up and to the right and every value. But the market's repriced. And so, you know, one has to be realistic. And, you know, we're seeing all these flavors. For a long time, none of this happened. There were no recaps. Nobody went out of business. Nobody bought out their founder, their investors. You know, it was just raised. It was A to B, C to A to B to C to da 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 da. And, you know, and it was all a given. You know, if I'm cynical about it, it was, you know, the game was not about building value. It was just getting to the next round. From the investors, it was just getting a markup. For the founders, it was just raising more at a higher valuation. And the fundamentals be damned. And I think now, and that's a very cynical view, but I think there was some of that, quite a bit of that going on. I think now people have realized, okay, the music is stopping. And so, you know, it's back to building value. And if you don't, there isn't going to be another round.
I think a lot of people also saw the venture ecosystem as a possibility to, for example, hype up their company, do some secondaries, and then also have like a financial baseline that they made for themselves. And then they could look what comes out of it. This is a very harsh perspective, but sometimes I'm not sure if the founders actually really ever cared about the topic they're tackling. So that's not true for a lot of founders, but some of them. And at the same time, I think, back to what you said, one of the biggest questions is, how do I decide if I shut down, if I have to like try to shift the gear up a bit to also still make it happen and to grind it out, and or also understand, okay, either shutting down or switching gears to go faster, both are not the cases to do. I want to build a sustainable company and figure out together with my investors what is the best way to do that. So how would you assess such a situation?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, some of the companies that are, we're seeing, you know, flat rate. So in the last few years, it was growth at all costs. The only thing that mattered was growth. Forget how much you burn. Now I think there's, you know, you've got to be much more sensible with your burn rate. So a lot of companies are flat, revenue is flat, but costs have gone way down and burn has gone way down and runway has gone way up. I think the number one objective is to make the money you have in the bank last, ideally to break even. I think if you can get to break even, you're the master of your own fate. And then you can decide later, do you need to raise more capital or are you never going to raise again or whatever. So we strongly encourage our companies to try to get to break even and not focus so much on getting to the next round. And so I encourage a lot of our companies to, you know, cut or find ways to reduce their burn to you know, get to break even. Because I think so I think that's the main way that you know, companies can sort of then decide how they want to go from there. And I think some investors are disappointed when companies are flat revenue for the next couple of years, even though you know, they're either generating EBITDA or generating less burn. My view is you know, that's sort of correcting for some of the mistakes of the past, or at least getting us to a point where you know, we are less dependent on the capital markets. And so I think that's the main way to do it. I mean, there are other things you can do along the way. You know, some companies are merging with other private companies and, you know, or obviously will just sell themselves. You know, I mean, obviously there was the acqui-hire, which happened a lot more in the go-go times. I think that's less common, but I do think M&A, you know, just as a quick comment, because I was thinking about this yesterday with some situations we have. Everyone says to me, you know, when things are great, we don't want to sell the company. And when things are bad, and literally they say, if we hit a wall, we'll sell the company. And it's actually quite the opposite. So one of the challenges of this market has been a lot of companies do want to sell now, but they can't, but they could have 2 years ago. And, you know, unfortunately the VCs, and we're guilty of this too, but I think I'm always the one that says before every round, let's consider M&A. And everyone's like, are you crazy? We're growing like... It's like, that's exactly why we should consider M&A, because you're growing like crazy. But I do think as a venture-backed startup, M&A should always be not in the front of your mind, but in the back of your mind. You are in the business of exits, ultimately. Everybody knows that. Doesn't mean you build just for the flip. But and I think a lot of the thinking during the go-go days was you never sell. And now a lot of companies want to sell, and they're like, how come no one wants to buy? And it's like, well, you know, because you're not growing anymore, or because, you know, they're looking at the valuation and they don't think they can pay what you want to get. So anyway, that was a bit of a tangent, but I think it's a good reminder for founders to, so much of this is timing. And you do have to be thoughtful about, you know, do you have massive tailwinds? You're not always going to have tailwinds. You're not always going to have headwinds either. When you have those tailwinds, you got to take advantage of them. And when you have headwinds, you got to reassess and do things like, you know, reduce costs and get to break even if you can. So I think too many people kind of forget that either it's always, you know, they think it's always going to be rosy and you know, sort of at least be prepared for these tough times.
I think I would love to quickly switch perspectives, because from a VC perspective, you said a lot of investors are not happy with flat revenue and stuff like that. Also, it feels a bit like a bit counterintuitive why this would be helpful for a better outcome if companies have flat revenue. But you mentioned it slightly, and I want to pull it out and explain a bit. What you mentioned is you then have that means keeping the revenue at the same level, even if there were mistakes before, even when the organization was not set up correctly yet or had room for improvement. So the fundamentals will be put together better, hopefully. If not, then it might be could be a concern. But you're building a more solid base to then at some point maybe accelerate again, or becoming profitable, or at least not burned that much anymore. So there are so many parts that feel counterintuitive at first, because we haven't talked about them for 5 years or 8 years because we didn't have to, that are so important to hear and to state, that founders can think about them and internalize and figure out what is best for their own situation right now. And not only think about their investors, of course, you still have to be in a partnership, but think about, okay, what's best for our company right now. And just because your investor says, hey, please 2x next year, which is more of a 2020-2021 sentence that people might have, or statement that people might have said, but think about, okay, what do I think is actually relevant right now, and how can I ensure that we survive the next 2, 3, 4 years? Because we all forgot, startups are a very, very high risk environment. And even if you're in a Series A or Series B, you're definitely not too big to fail. So there are so many companies that will get issues right now.
Even stage companies, you're fragile at every stage.
And that's something that we forgot, because it felt like everybody was like in God mode, every startup, for the last 5, 6, 7 years, because it just went on and on and on. And then a lot of founders exited companies, which was perfect timing for a lot of them. But also, now under the hood, the problems arise for the growth stage companies as well. So you have to, as a founder, you sometimes have a very good feeling for what can be the next step for the company. And hopefully you have people that you want and feel comfortable discussing this with. So just highlighting and putting together what you said and setting it into perspective a bit.
Yeah, I think that's very well said. And I think that, it's a silly example, but, you know, to your point about companies are fragile, we forgot that a little bit, and the fundamentals, like, you know, I think about the Peloton story partially because I like my Peloton, and I know that I think they have a studio in Germany as well, in the UK. But, you know, during the COVID, they were growing like crazy. People like me needed to work out, and we bought the bike, and, the stock went like this, the revenue went like this, and they acquired a company, and then they overbuilt completely. And the stock crashed, the CEO resigned, you know, they pushed CEO out, founder, CEO. That was a public company. So things are fragile at every stage, and you can make, you know, I'm sure they had all good intentions. They were growing crazy. They needed capacity. They invested in capacity, and then boom, the market just fell out from under them. So you're fragile at all these stages. And I think that, I think you have to sort of remember that, it truly is a marathon, not a sprint. And, I think it's, from the VC perspective, I'd say the other thing that sort of happened in this period is that you had a lot of VCs. You know, you made this comment earlier that you've only seen this bull market, because that's kind of the period in which you've kind of watched this industry, grow. And I think a lot of VCs also have only seen this market. And so I think the advice they were giving was to focus on top line and growth and not worry about the rest. And I think, you know, it's funny, like I to be on the other side of this, I don't feel like I'm so old, only, 46 years old, but I've seen a few of these cycles now, and I've lived through them. The financial crisis, I was selling, dental technology stuff that we had innovated. I was very much lived through the dot-com crash. And so, I always felt like top line and growth were two interesting data, obviously two very important data points, but what about burn rate? What about runway? And what about, and I think this is actually the metric that a lot of investors are now looking at, which is how much capital did it take to get to a certain point? Because I think investors are now going back to extrapolating based on that and saying, look, Micah's company got to 2 million ARR on 1 million or 2 million in investment. That's pretty good. But you know, that company took $10 million to get to $2 million in investment. So, you know, yes, it's a $2 million company. Maybe they're, you know, starting to hit their stride, but that's an awful lot of money to get there. And so, yeah, and sometimes, you know, there's a reason why it took that much. You know, certainly when I was building hardware and software, it was expensive to build it. So there's a lot of reasons why not all companies take different amounts of capital. Hardware is different than software, clean tech, whatever. But I would say in general, I think investors are now starting to say, how much capital went in to get here? And it's kind of why we've started to advise our seed companies to raise really quite a bit less, or at least, you know, let's say two or less, because I think they're much more likely to get a second check than if they raise 4 to 5. I just think the bar is going to be so much higher, and it's going to be potentially unreasonably high. Whereas I think if you raise 2 and you can get to product market fit, some early customers, somebody's going to take a bet on the next round on that. And I think there's a psychological threshold somewhere 2 to 3 where it's like, that's small enough that we don't expect you to be at 2 million ARR. You know, and it sequences the money to the milestones much better. So anyhow, that's, you know, I'm happy to see that. I think investors are, you know, but getting back to the point about, you know, there was really a generation of investors who just never saw this period, and now they're having to learn quickly. And I think the last thing I'd say about this, I think some founders feel burned or a bit of whiplash. They feel like, my board was telling me to grow, spend. Nobody cared about burn rate, there was always another check that would come. And now all of a sudden they're saying, what the hell, you're burning too much. And, you know, I think these founders are justified in saying, dude, you know, last month you told me this, now you're telling me, you know, like, and I feel for these founders, especially young founders who, you know, of course they're going to listen to their investors. Like, of course they're going to get advice and sort of look to their investors and how to spend their capital at a high level. So I really feel like in some ways the founders got a raw deal in some ways over this sort of change in market, you know, in macro.
I think there's another issue that we will see, and I'm not sure how much you will be able to comment on it, because you have a lot of co-investors. And you want to be nice to them. But one thing that I see as an issue and observe it from the outside, there are too many too large funds. There are so many funds that build
for sure
to fund sizes where they have to have 1, 2, 3 unicorns or companies worth like 5 billion or even 10 billion. And they're talking about, yeah, but we only have like, we don't only need to hit 1 or 2 decacorns. And you're like, yeah, but how many decacorns have you seen in the last years that are actually like after 10 years at that or 12 years at that point? And how likely is it that you will hit 2 or 3 of them? So there are so many delusional VCs and investors now, and that doesn't only count for the investors that only saw the hype cycle. This also counts for investors that saw other market sentiments before, but forgot about them and were like, yeah, but now we have the opportunity to raise a $1 billion fund. So we will do that. And I would say optimize a bit more for management fees than for actual return and outcome. I know that's a bit harsh and doesn't hold true and valid for all of the funds. That's more to put it a bit, say it a bit, in a harsh tone, but a bit clickbaity. But so, yeah, I'm interested how this will turn out.
Yeah, I think you know, I remember actually back when we had raised money from CRV, Charles River Ventures, you know, for my startup Brontes, and actually at the time the market had gone through a correction as well, and Ted Dindersmith, who was a legendary investor, who was on our board, he actually decided to give back some of the capital from the fundraise as a fund because he felt he had gotten too big. They decided they had raised too big of a fund. You almost never hear about that. I don't remember the last time since then I've heard a fund try to get smaller.
I think Founders Fund did, right?
Maybe Founders. Yeah, I think you're right. I think
simply,
that.
yeah, they halved, I think, the fund size.
So there are a few, and you always have to ask, did they do it deliberately or did they do it because they couldn't raise? Founders Fund probably
Fair.
deliberately they could raise. I think it's a really important point. I think you know, I was having this conversation the other day with some folks that the AUM business is a real good business if you're a bank, if you're JP Morgan or HSBC or you know, one of the big banks, or if you're Fidelity or Vanguard. Asset management makes a lot of sense because you're not on the hook for performance. You're really a marketplace or a service, and you're getting a small yield, a tiny yield on a volume, right? So you're selling index funds or checking accounts, or look, you're in the volume business. So by definition, the greater your asset base, the more revenue you make. That's sort of true and not totally true in venture. And by the way, before I get to venture, private equity is kind of that way in the sense that while private equity, I think, has very much optimized for fees, Blackstone, KKR, the whole bit of them. But there are massive companies that can be taken private. These are established businesses that can be billions. So there's an opportunity to put a lot of capital to work. In the startup world, by definition, these things are startups. They're small. So there's only so much capital you can put to work. And there's only, as you point out, a very few of them are going to get to the scale of the Trade Desk, the Ubers, the Teslas, et cetera. And so I think there was, and I think you're pointing this out, a little bit of a mislearning of trying to use the examples of asset managers like mutual funds and hedge funds and private equity to venture. And I don't think it actually is the same. I actually think there's a reason venture was always a cottage industry. It was a cottage industry because by definition, it was small. There was only so many startups. That number has grown a lot. And I think a lot of the things that were done by these bigger funds like Andreessen in some ways have been very good for the industry. And I think the industry was too much of a cottage industry. I think it was a bit of an old boys club 20 years ago and before that. So I think some of this has been good, but I think it went too far. And as you point out, it became more about looking like an asset manager and less about being a venture capital firm. And I think people are rethinking that now a little bit. It's tough. Because as you also said, when you get so much in fees, it's hard to turn that off. Just like the companies we were talking about earlier, who spend so much on the marketers and the engineers, and they grow and they hire a lot of people. So did these firms. I think it was Sequoia just announced they're letting go of, I think it was 20% or some percentage of their talent team. So they're doing the same thing that the companies are doing because they're realizing well, the talent market has changed, but also, it may not look exactly like these other industries where just aggregating capital is the name of the game. And I think much like the startups got a little bamboozled by valuations and dollars in, so did these funds. Because at the end of the day, I think our job is to build great companies and deliver multiples or IRR for our investors. And frankly, I'm a big investor in my own fund. So that's what I care about. Gathering assets under management is not the name of the game and actually may make it harder for me. The simple math is it's easier for me to return an $85 million. It's easier for me to get a 3x or a 5x on 85 than it is 500. I mean, it's just easier math. So I think we went through a explosion of assets under management. The last thing I'll say is that, some of it is, I don't think it's an issue of blame, but I do think, this starts from even the LPs because the LPs wanted to allocate more money to venture capital. And it's hard for them to write $5 and $10 million checks. They write that to us because we're a small fund. But, if you're a massive pension fund in, Europe or in the US, or you're a major university that has a huge endowment, you want to put $100 million to work. You might want to put $200 million to work or $50 million to work. And so, of course, you're going to write a big check. And, the VCs were just building the product the LPs asked for. And And I think now, again, that's unraveling a little bit, and people are realizing, okay, well, to write a $100 million check and get 1.2x, that's not, I might as well go in the public markets. But by the way, I might as well put it in treasuries. You know, the Fed just raised rates again. So like a lot of better alternatives. But I think a lot of the same, if we were to distill it down, a lot of the same habits and trends that were happening at the startup level were also happening at the venture level. Like everybody was kind of, you know, a little bit drunk at the party.
I would say, because you said VCs were building the product that LPs wanted, but it's a bit like a startup that scales too early, because most of these funds don't have the, I just take the example of product market fit, because it's, as you mentioned, it's easier to put 85 million to work than putting 500 million to work. And there's only so much return that you can make. And it's super, super hard to replicate. On the one hand, it's super hard to replicate it. So holding yourself accountable to do it for a second fund is one thing. And then for a second fund that is five times the size, it's even harder. So yeah, I'm not sure if, or maybe, of course, we can say, okay, throughout the hype cycle, there are so many more startups. Therefore, there are so many more good startups, and you can, the total amount of returns that are possible to make increased as well. But yeah, so it's super hard to see, and I'm very interested in seeing how it turns out, because I think it's a risk as well for the whole ecosystem, because it at least bears the possibility of imploding a bit from the VC side, from the founder side, because they're not happy with what their outcome will be after a few years, and from the employee side that they say, hey, we invested so much from our perspective too. We relied on stock options, and we were sold on a dream here, and nothing turned out. So I'm interested in how much impact all these decisions will have.
Yeah, I think it's really tough on the entrepreneurs you were talking a lot about earlier in this podcast. The entrepreneurs that are building good, you know, the middle 60%, the middle 70%, the companies that, you know, found product market fit, are growing bit by bit, maybe 50% a year, maybe even 100% a year, or not growing, but dramatically reducing burn, starting to generate EBITDA, but aren't returning material amounts to the large fund. And so those investors are kind of walking away. They're not disappointed. They're saying the penny isn't so shiny anymore. And that stinks, because, you know, that entrepreneur who's building some real value and should feel quite good about, and may end up, you know, building a life-changing business for themselves, feels like they, you know, disappointed and failed. And I think that's not the case. And I think in some cases it will actually create failures that didn't have to be. It will be a self-fulfilling prophecy, because they were set up to be, you know, I have teenagers, so I think about this. It's a little bit like, you know, all the parents saying, did the kid get into Harvard or Stanford? And then, you know, the kid that didn't go there but still goes to a good school feels like they didn't accomplish what the parents wanted. And, you know, it's so ridiculous, because, you know, there are many great schools. Not everyone has to go to those top schools. Not everyone comes. We all know the reality of it. And yet there was such pressure to be that top 1 or 2%. And I think, you know, it's almost as if that's all the investors cared about. They only cared about the top, you know, 5 and 10%. And I hope that's not the case. I hope some of these, you know, I will say, though, the good news is the good investors who have been around, I think, like us, even at bigger funds, are spending time with the companies in the middle. They don't give up. They join the boards. They're on the calls. You know, I see it from Sequoia. I see it from a lot of the good seed funds. I see it from, you know, a lot of the partners we know in the industry. They don't give up. And even if the outcome is not necessarily, it doesn't look like it's going to be the fund returner, that they're okay with that. And the reason they're okay with that is two things. This is how I think about it. and we think about as fun. One is, this is where our reputation is made. It's easy, you know, Uber wasn't calling us for feedback every week. Once Uber grew quickly, they were on the mission. Obviously, they had their challenges, but like that's the easy case. And the companies that fail quickly and ultimately, you know, that also in some ways is easy. That, you know, fixes itself. The stuff in the middle is where, you know, the founders need us, where they need the advice. They need to figure out how to, you know, get from step one to step two. And I think that we spend more time on those founders. And if you said, well, but that's not the most efficient use of time, you should spend your most of your time on the top 10%, a little bit of time in the middle and nothing on the bottom. I don't think that's what good venture investors should be doing. I don't think they should be managing their time to value, to value of the fund. And I thankfully I haven't seen a lot of the investor behavior where. And the other reason why I think that's important not to do it that way is you never know. Some of our biggest companies had moments that looked like they were going to fail, and everybody could have given up. And that's, you know, Trade Desk is a perfect example. We needed to bridge them capital. You know, it's now $30 billion public company. It was higher at one point, but you know, thank God my partner Eric, you know, leaned in. SeatGeek, also a really valuable company for us that does you know, ticketing, primary and secondary ticketing. COVID happened. Who would have thought this company, which was on the IPO path, nobody would be going to music shows or games or, you know, football, soccer, baseball, all that stuff, theater. And so we had to help put together interim round. Could have given up, could have said, I don't know when the hell games are going to come back, but I'm not going to worry about that. But, you know, things turn around. And just because everything's fragile, the opposite is also true, which is trajectories can change very quickly. Fortunes can change very quickly. Tailwinds can happen. You know, I remember visiting Moderna, but when they were getting started, thinking like, these guys, I don't understand the science. And then COVID hits and, you know, they have one of the perfect, you know, paradigms for delivering a vaccine. So it's just a reminder that, you know, you don't want to give up. What today's top 10 may not be the top 10. And if I look back at our decade plus of experience, it's shocking. And I think any investor who's been doing this around the same time or longer than me will say, it's amazing how things moved in terms of value over time. It was not predictable at all.
It's amazing to hear. And I think these are good thoughts that everybody could, every founder, but also every investor can think about right now. Because I think we turned it from a very hands-on, like, how do I think about my own company? What do I do with it? To a philosophy session on what we both see at the moment happening, and then more of your experience on how to get along with that and how to... what to think about. So I really enjoyed it, and I'm super thankful that you came on the show and on the podcast. So Micah, I will definitely link to your LinkedIn profile in the show notes, to Founder Collective, of course, as well. And from my side, I have to say thank you. I'm looking forward to see what's happening on your side throughout the next years. And I would be happy to hand over a last time for the closing words of this podcast episode.
Yeah, I think despite the storm clouds and the doom and gloom, I would just say that I think these are the best times to start a company. I think now that all the hype and noise is kind of over, I think you can go in your bunker and build real product and test and have, you know, test customers and not feel like, oh man, if I don't grow month over month, starting tomorrow, I'm doomed. I think this is the perfect time to build real value. And I think we're gonna see some amazing companies, not to mention AI and all the other trends that are going on, but technology is just becoming more and more important, bigger part of our economy. There's a lot of tailwinds. Yeah, there's a lot of macro stuff, but the macro doesn't matter that much for startups. The micro is really what's important. So I'd encourage founders not to be discouraged. Quite the opposite. I'd rather build now than 2 or 3 years ago. So I think this is a great time. I encourage it. And I think And for investors too, I think we're going to have a really exciting vintage over the next couple of years.
Thank you, Michael.